Before we start, I just wanted to take a minute and thank you guys for leaving a review, whether you're leaving it for the podcast, for the ebook, for my gift ideas as right now, December. It really means a lot, especially as I take a little break during the Christmas season or holiday, whatever you celebrate. And so I want to take a step back from social media because we also have to detox our minds and, you know, that emotional well-being and all that. So that is really the way that people find me. So for example, here's an awesome review from Crady. She said, insightful and informative. I listened to episode number 21. The interview answered a lot of the questions I've had on the subject. The interview was clear and the progression was smooth, which added to the experience. Thank you so much, Astrid. So reviews like that make me very happy because I want to know what it is that you guys want to know about, what you want to learn about. Crady, I cannot tell you how important it is to have people like you to take, you know, a minute out of their way, their day, and see how they feel, whether it's about the podcast, my articles, or my website. Like I said, in December, I create healthy gift ideas. There are several on my website. You could go and find them. I have an ebook in case you're not aware. It's called The Top 10 Foods for a Super Healthy Lymphatic System, which is now 50% off on my website. And so again, that's how people find me. I am an army of one, which seem to have an awesome group of people join me, hopefully, little by little. So I'm just trying to continue to get you guys the good stuff always. So thank you so much for your time. And if you guys missed some of the Black Friday and Cyber Monday deals that I've managed to work with some of my partners, head on over to the website and check the gift guides or the resources page. Also on Instagram, I have a highlight exclusively for those savings this year. I have exclusive discount codes that Heal You Naturally gets, for example, with BioTrust, some of my amazing partners, Good State, Real Mushrooms. These are all phenomenal partners that care about the environment and their products. So they've shared that with me and I negotiated some of them for you guys who follow me. And for my new listeners, go ahead and check them out. Hey everyone, welcome back to Heal Your Natural Wellness Podcast. I am Astrid from healyournaturally.com. This episode number 26 is about debunking the latest fitness myths, how behavior and unresolved trauma affects progress, plus hormones and metabolism. I think this is a very important topic because lots of us have dealt with underlying conditions such as autoimmune disease or have always battled with weight, having trouble maintaining, losing, or even gaining weight for some people. So this time I brought a phenomenal guest. He is a very well-seasoned coach and fitness trainer, nutritionist. You're going to hear all about him in a little bit, but I think this is an important topic because the fitness industry sometimes paints a picture of how you're supposed to look, and that is not what is today. You know, we have come to the realization that body shaming image and things like that, right? So I think this is important because our children are watching, nieces, nephews, whether you have children or not. And so I think we really need to shift the way the fitness industry works. So definitely stay tuned. You're absolutely going to love it.
Hey, everyone. Today, I have a phenomenal guest. His name is Coach Tim. He's an MED, CSCS. He is also a nutritionist, health coach, and fitness specialist who helps busy folks eat, move, and live better so they can enjoy radiant health, vibrant energy, and contagious confidence. Tim earned his master's degree from the University of Texas in exercise physiology, sports science, and nutrition, and he holds the prestigious CSCS and PN2 certifications. Tim is a director of community and coaching for BioTrust Nutrition and is a trusted health advocate. Over 2 million men and women read his weekly health tips newsletters and blogs and view his watchdog health videos online. Welcome to the Heal Your Natural Wellness Podcast, Coach Tim.
Hey, thanks so much, Astrid. It is an honor and pleasure to be here. And Hello to everyone out there watching, listening. It is just a privilege to be here with you. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, no, thank you so much for being here. It's an absolute honor to have you. I am delighted. Guys, we're going to learn so much. You have no idea. Coach Tim has a wealth of information. He is super genuine and he's amazing. And that's why he's here, like all of my guests. So without further ado, we're going to go ahead and move forward. Coach Tim, why don't you briefly tell us about your journey as a nutritionist, health coach, and fitness specialist?
Yeah, of course, Ashley. It's always fun to go back and think about how we got started here. So I think many people in the fitness field, I grew up in sports and athletics, and exercise became important for me to progress at the level that I wanted to. And through my life in high school and college and beyond, fitness and nutrition became an anchor for me to get through things, not only just to change my body, but like I said, an anchor through trials and tribulations, which we were more than happy to get into. But it was the rock. Those things were a rock for me. And I saw how it influenced me, mind, body, and spirit. And I thought it was a gift. Mm-hmm. And it was a gift that I'm very passionate about and like to share with people. And so that led me into, you know, more advanced education, certifications, and a career in the field. This is obviously something that is relevant to everyone. And it's really a blessing to be able to share that with people and hopefully help them in some small way to move forward towards their own health, fitness, wellness, goals and objectives in life.
That's awesome. When you're passionate about what you do, it's no longer a job, you know, it's more like part of your life, right? So when you really, and you definitely love what you do, I could tell, you know, I haven't known you for a long time, but definitely I could feel, you know, how passionate you are. You're very knowledgeable and you genuinely love what you do. And that's something that I admire in someone. So thank you for sharing that with us. So I was going to ask you, why don't you tell us about, we're going to jump right into the reason why you're here. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the biggest fitness myths, and can you share some examples?
There are so many that we can share many examples. And I think that the thing, you know, the myths is a little, it's a bit of a superlative, you know, that there's some truths to many of these things that are out there, but it's because, like, as humans, I think we like things in black and white. We like things in absolutes. We like, you know, things to be very small and bite-sized, that the message can get lost in translation often, that there's nuances to a lot of these different statements. And, you know, I've got a long list of these things, so we'll rattle through some of them and maybe we can expand on a few that I think are particularly relevant. But, yes. You know, one of the first that comes to mind is that, you know, we'll speak to weight loss. I know not everyone's interested in weight loss, but many people, the lion's share of people, really, you know, if they're not, then someone in their life is, right? So that, you know, you hear a lot of fitness professionals say that it's just a matter of calories in versus calories out. You just need to move more and eat less. And there's truth to those things, but that's extremely unhelpful advice to someone who's struggling with their weight. And, you know, let's look at the calories in versus calories out piece of the puzzle. If you think you're so smart and you're so intelligent that you can actually measure how many calories you're consuming and how many calories you're burning, then that's a mistake. Okay. So I do think that that it can be a useful tool to track, you know, to try to ballpark your energy expenditure and your energy intake, but you're not going to be accurate. Like, just for example, if you are using these databases that you can find for how many calories are in this food or that food, or how many carbs, those estimates are, you know, anywhere from 20 to 30% margin of error. So just right off the bat, 20 to 30% margin of error there. And that doesn't tell you how the absorbable energy or how much energy can actually be extracted from those foods. So the gut microbiome, or, you know, your microbiome makeup, certain types of people have, you know, greater ratio of X bacteria in their body, which can extract more calories. Certain people have less of that, so they are, you know, less efficient at extracting energy. Then you have cooking. Cooking certain foods can increase your body's ability to access the energy. So you have all these different variables which can influence the energy in portion of the equation. And then on the other side, on the energy out, there's all kinds of different variables that can influence that, you know, like how much sleep you got, how much muscle mass you carry, how, like, did you really exercise, you know, this hard, or did you really do this much? And so all of these things are just estimates, and they can vary considerably from person to person and from day to day based on a variety of factors. So we're just not that good at measuring calories in versus calories out. So that's part of it. Now, like I said, those are useful tools at times to gain some awareness, but to rely completely on external data to make decisions is not always helpful. Really, if we, to take another step further, nutrition, eating well, consistently eating well is a skill. It's a skill that needs to be developed like anything. Yeah. And we can all develop these skills. This is the idea of having this growth mindset, is that any skill is, no matter how difficult, is buildable with persistent and patient practice. And so being a better eater is just about practicing. And so that's part of it. But that requires, you know, tuning into internal cues as opposed to just relying on external rules. And so a lot of times when we're focused on calories in versus calories out, we're looking for this external validation, this external feedback, when really we need to look within to see, you know, how we're eating and things like that. So that's part of the equation. Then the move more, eat less, you know, that part of the equation is not, doesn't tell us a whole lot either. And one of the things that leads me to another myth is that you have to exercise to lose weight. Now, I'm an exercise fanatic. I love exercise. I coach people on exercise. But part of the problem, if we focus on the exercise piece of the puzzle, is that one, just by exercising alone, it doesn't really work that well for weight loss. We see that in the studies over and over. I've seen it in my practice for 20 years now. If you just focus on the exercise piece of the puzzle, it's not very good at weight loss. It's really, really good at keeping weight off for a lot of people. And it's really good for changing the composition of your body, but for weight loss, not so great. And one thing that I find is that when people focus just on the exercise piece of the puzzle, they actually find it's like a license to eat whatever you want. Or they say that 150 calories that I burn on the treadmill, which again, we don't even know that that's what we burn, but that allows me to go have this or that. And so it's an excuse. That's part of it. And then this one is, I think, the big part of that is when, you know, you do your 30 minutes of exercise, it's also for a lot of people, it's an excuse to be more sedentary throughout the day. And I would actually coach people to be more active throughout the day before I even worry about exercise. So, you know, on average, people are sitting, being sedentary for 10 to 14 hours per day. And they say if sitting's like the new smoking or whatever, but basically what that means is that even if you aren't exercising for the 30 to 60 minutes a day, and you're still sedentary for that much time, you have an increased risk of cardiovascular disease, stroke, diabetes, certain types of cancers, things like that, despite, you know, the working out notwithstanding. So we need to build fitness into our lives, as opposed to thinking it's just this small piece of the puzzle. So that's a long, there's probably like 2, 3, maybe even 4 myths there. And I'll pause for a moment if you want to comment on anything there, but otherwise we can just kind of move on to another one.
No, that was, listen, don't feel, people need to know these things. You know, I love the way you approach this, and you said something very important that I actually hadn't heard before. Like two things when you answered about the you know, counting calories and stuff like that. For example, I find it very tedious, to be completely honest. I've used my Fitness Pal, whatever, as of recently, Chronometer, which is the one that you scan. It's important because I'm measuring all the things, you know, in the background, which you're aware of. But you mentioned something really important. You said like those are just like, they're not accurate. It's just like a ballpark type of thing. And so I never thought about that. I'm like, oh, I'm measuring these things and I'm scanning and like that. I never thought it was that accurate. Like, you know, it's just, and also like what you said, like there's like so many aspects to it, like the microbiome and the energy expenditure and all that. And guys, you know, like I never think about these things. That's why it's awesome to have Coach Tim here to remind us that none of these things are like, what is it, like written on stone, right, or for lack of a better word, right?
Yes.
You need to kind of like, and I'm constantly doing, some of you know me by now, I'm always A-B testing, you know. I was talking to Coach Tim before, and we were touching some really good topics that we're potentially going to bring in. But yeah, you know, if you could also, like, we're going to move on to the next question. We'll probably go back to what you were saying before, but thank you for answering that. I wanted to talk about something really awesome that I just found out through Coach Tim. And one of our conversations, we touched on the topic of insulin resistance, which is something that I've been dealing with for the last year or so, as some of you know. And you mentioned cognitive dietary restraint.
Yeah.
I would love for you to share with my audience about that. It really resonated. It's something that I think I may have heard of it once, but I don't even know. So that is something that I think I've been dealing with. And so I would love for you to share with us more, you know, about it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it kind of feeds well into that topic we just talked about. Like, for instance, this cognitive dietary restraint can affect anyone, but it is particularly prevalent in women. And what it is because that's a science mumbo jumbo. And what it means is that just this like almost constant preoccupation with food and with particular regard to your weight. And yes. So just this, you know, constantly monitoring and controlling your food intake, whether it's the amount, whether it's the types of foods. And like I said, this is something that I've personally dealt with and that many people that I've worked with have dealt with. And so why this can be a problem for many reasons. You might even be able to think if this sounds familiar, you already know how it affects you, that it can affect you socially. It can affect you emotionally. It can just preoccupation, just this idea of being preoccupied with something, like that means you can't put your energy anywhere else essentially, but it's also a source of stress. And so when they take subjects, women mostly, who have this, you know, and there's different psychological assessments to measure, you know, that this cognitive dietary restraint, these validated tools. And so you get these women that have been, you know, I won't say diagnosed because it's not a disease or anything like that, but have been assessed with cognitive dietary restraint, and they measure cortisol levels. They find that cortisol levels are elevated. And I think as most people know, cortisol is a stress hormone. Now, cortisol gets a bad rap, but it's in the body for a reason. It has multiple reasons. It's an important hormone. It's just like everything in the body. What Joel Green in his book, The Immunity Code, talks about biological duality. Balance. It's called biological duality. You know, that it's not good or bad. It's the same thing. I'm gonna take a step back just for a second. I'll come back to this. It's the same thing with food. Food is not good or bad. When we assign these good and bad terminologies to foods, we're basically making eating a moral act. And when we make food a moral act or eating a moral act, we also that reflects onto us. So I ate bad food, so now I'm a bad person. And so then this psychological what the hell effect kicks in. And then I just like, well, I did one bad thing. I might as well just go down the path. And then I beat myself up over it. And so this whole idea of good and bad, this morality thing with food is important, but also biologically speaking, things have dual purpose, just like inflammation. Inflammation is not inherently bad. If you don't have the proper inflammatory response, you won't be able to recover from injury. You won't be able to fight off infection. We need the right amount and the right times and the right places. And the same thing with cortisol. But with this cognitive dietary restraint, we see these persistent chronic elevation of cortisol. And that can have negative effects on bone health. So bone mineral density can have effects on metabolic health. So basically inducing a state of insulin resistance, inducing a state of glucose intolerance with high elevated cortisol, because one of cortisol's jobs is to liberate blood sugar. So think about this, your stress response, the old classic example of you're getting chased by a lion, right? This is not happening anywhere, but this is the fight or flight. This is the stress response. And cortisol kicks in and it liberates fatty acids. It liberates glucose because the body needs energy to run, right? Or fight or whatever. Well, that's kind of a general idea of what cortisol does from a blood sugar standpoint. So it's going to create this temporary state of insulin resistance in order to liberate this glucose. So that's part, you know, cortisol also, I would say, makes you dumb because it's so distracting. It can actually shrink the brain, but it's also, the stress is distracting. Wow. So elevated cortisol levels shrink portions of the brain to make you dumb, but also distracted, you know, makes you feel anxious, can make you feel depressed. If it's persistent, it can affect your gut. So when your cortisol levels are high, your digestion is going to be off because that's part of the fight or flight response. But when we're talking about digestion, we want to be in the parasympathetic state. We want to be in the rest and digest. So it's going to make you feel bloated. It's cortisol can actually disrupt your gut microbiome. So it can negatively influence the gut microbiome. It can make you fat, I would say, by one, there tends to be more cortisol receptors in the belly area. And so people who have high cortisol levels tend to store more fat in the belly area. And then certainly cortisol, aka stress, can influence eating behaviors. Whether it's, not everyone overeats when they're feeling stressed, but many people overeat. Many people, when they are stressed, they reach for comfort foods, and comfort foods usually aren't like carrots and bananas. They're usually, you know,
kale, right? Yes.
They're more like those highly palatable foods and things like that. So this is the idea of cognitive dietary restraint, that it sets you up for this elevated cortisol, which is this heightened period of, you know, stress. And I think that most people realize that chronic persistent stress is bad news for all the, from head to toe, from the body, from head to toe, all the different systems of the body are impacted. And, you know, and then when the wheels come off, they really come off. And what I mean by that is that whole thing is just that what the hell effect kicks in very easily in these cases. And it's not as easy as like, oh, you have cognitive dietary restraint, just get over it. That this is when some cognitive behavioral therapy might come into play, and we have to do a little bit more. Because why is it so important for you to control your food intake? What other area of your life are you lacking control that you need to control this piece so much? And so usually there's some other thing going on in life.
Underlying,
right?
Yeah.
And so it's about the food, but it's not always about the food.
Right. That's an excellent answer. I was just going to say that, for example, I believe in my case, and the reason why I like to be, you know, vulnerable when it comes to this with you guys is because I know that other people may be dealing with this. For example, in my case, I became extremely concerned, which I've mentioned that to Coach Tim before. It was because of my family history. So both my parents were diabetic, and I started observing how they were using like Splenda, whatever, all these things. Unfortunately, we didn't know better, but for preventative measures, I was always so concerned about eating, and I've kind of taken a step back with that, and especially when I'm around my son, because I don't, you know, we got to be careful how we present things to them. So he heard me. He's like, "Oh, mommy, I know that you don't like, for example, pizza. For me, it's one of those foods that I actually, and now that we're talking about it, I kind of like resent, you know, when it's like, oh, we're going to a party, we're gonna have a party pizza, and I'm like, okay, no,
right?
Because I know the pizza has, you know, what, just an example, right? So I'm just going to say that in my case, some of those foods became sort of like the enemy because of my concern about diabetes, you know, potentially would raise my sugars. I was predisposed, but cancel those words. I, you know, because genetically and all that, but, that was on my end. It was because of that, because I was so concerned about my family history, stroke, all those cardiovascular disease. And so that was always my concern. And even though I was always, you know, I've always been active, because I am definitely not lazy by any stretch of the imagination. I love to be active, exercise and things like that. It's still, I've had periods where I am not following, like the diet the way I should, or times where I would be snacking late at night and things like that. So, that's a whole other topic, but it's definitely important to mention that, with this issue that we're talking about, how can someone find out if they have, what is it called again?
Cognitive dietary restraint. Well,
dietary restraint.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that, Ashley, because I think it is, you know, to go back on that, I think it is important for the fitness community, health and fitness community in general, to share our personal stories with other people out there, to to let everyone know that we're on the same page. There's this common humanity. There's this self-compassion. We're all on the same page. And, you know, we're not perfect. The fitness community has, you know, you go to Instagram and you'll see all these perfect bodies and all these perfect people. And unfortunately that image gets portrayed and it makes things a lot harder and kind of feeds into the cognitive dietary restraint. But I think that, you know, people like you who share, who are vulnerable and share the fact that, that we're not perfect. And I'll be happy to share more of my experiences too. I'm far from perfect, makes it feel okay. I think that's part of the process of getting rid of this cognitive dietary restraint, that you don't have to be perfect, that we don't have to think in absolute terms, that we think about, we have to think more on a continuum, and something is always going to be better than nothing. And that applies to everything. And you know,
That's a great point,
because the part of the cognitive dietary restraint thing is that I have to be perfect. I have to be perfect because, you know, if I'm not, then I lost control again. And I think we have to take us to go back to your question. How do we deal with it? We do have to look to see if there's some other underlying issue, some other thing that we're controlling. For instance, you know, I've struggled with this type of thing. Like, controlling food has been an important part of my life for 20 years because, you know, I've dealt with an alcoholic parent. I've dealt with depression. I've dealt with like my world being turned upside down for all these different reasons, which it's just life. It's no one's fault, just life. And when other areas of life, this is what I talked about at the beginning, these things have been an anchor for me and, you know, fitness and nutrition, because there's been other areas of life that have been out of control or seemingly out of control, but these were things that I could control. And so I think that's part of things. Mm. Now, if this topic, this preoccupation with food, that type of thing resonates with anybody out there, then you know that you have some degree of this cognitive dietary restraint. Now, like I said, you could do a Google search and search for cognitive dietary restraint and assessment. And there's tool assessment tools out there. If you have a therapist that you go to see, which is probably a good idea for almost everyone, you could talk about it there as well. And they would be able to, they might not know how to measure it per se, but they could look into it and help you out with that. But I think if the topic sounds familiar and sounds like it rings a bell, then you probably, I hate to say have it, but it's probably something that you're dealing with in some way or another. And I think, you know, to go back to one of the things that you were saying there too, Astrid, was you were talking about kids. And I think I would assume that many listeners have kids. I have kids of my own. And these are all teaching opportunities for us when we're talking about relationships with food. Because like you said, I don't know that we want to talk about foods being good or bad. And, you know, that this does that with the kids. I think we want to establish healthy relationships with food at a young age if we can, because it can last a lifetime. And so this is where I would talk about, you know, maybe creating a list of what might be like green light, yellow light, and red light foods for yourself, and maybe even helping your kids understand that. What it would mean would be like, for instance, a green light food is something that makes you feel light and energetic. It's something that supports whatever your goal is at this stage in your game. A red light food might be something that does do nothing for you, that doesn't support you or makes you feel like garbage, makes you feel heavy and lethargic, or is one of those foods that you just can't stop eating. And that could be a healthy food, you know? So that might be a red light food too. But just in the case of your son, like, mommy, why can't you have pizza? Well, I can have it. I just choose not to because I don't really like the way it makes me feel. If you feel okay having it though, and you can eat like one pizza piece, that's cool. That's great. That's no problem to have a little bit here or there. You know what I mean? So I think that there's teaching opportunities, and not to moralize and say pizza's bad for you or sugar is bad for you, because I think about the example of those like kids that were like under their parents' thumb up until they went away to college, and then they just, you know, drank until their livers failed. Yes. I'm joking somewhat, but you know what I mean? Like if you put them underneath your thumb for too long, when the training wheels come off, they're not going to know what to do. Same thing with money. It's all these things. So that's kind of the approach. I know we're not here to talk about like kids and nutrition, but I think we have an opportunity obligation as parents to kind of develop and harness a healthy relationship with kids and get them to, like I said, understand that like these fruits and vegetables are green light foods. They're going to give you the energy you want to run fast, to think smart, be, you know, quick and be funny and all that cool stuff that you want to do. And, you know, you can have some sugar, but there's a chance you're going to be you're going to be a little cranky in a little while, or your energy is going to fall off the cliff, you know, things like that. So anyway, you know, really the whole idea is that there's trade-offs with all of our choices.
Yes.
You know, if you choose one thing, you're not choosing something else. And you're also, you are making a choice to do this, but it has consequences. And when you do that, you're also not choosing something else.
Absolutely. That was a phenomenal answer. And listen, that you actually said something really, really good, because, you know, and it reminded me as a parent that, I try not to label good and bad food, even though I've kind of done it without even realizing. But when we, you know, we have them under the thumb, or like for example, I used to be a lot more strict when he was younger and stuff like that. But it's true. Like once they're not in front of you, they're going to go and eat. So luckily the way you want to do it, like with my son, for example, the way I've done it is like, you know, choices and like what you said, the green light, but in other words, and I'm like, you know, if this is not going to make you feel great and you know, you're going to feel a little bit different after if you eat all that sugar, just have a little bit, but I've encouraged him to eat better foods. Right. And he already knows at 10 years old that certain foods make him feel a certain way. And, I've actually tried to tell him, so kind of like let him make the choices, but guide them, right?
Awesome.
Because I do know, for example, I always say, listen, as far as you're in there in front of me, I will never give you soda per se,
right?
But I am fully aware that one day he may try it somewhere else. So what I've tried to do is say, this is going to make you feel a certain way. It's going to do a certain things to your body. And just remember that.
Yeah.
So anyway,
that's awesome.
That was a really good topic. Thank you so much for sharing that. We're going to move to the next question. So why is behavior change, when tying it up to what we're talking about, crucial when it comes to achieving long-term fitness goals? And also we could touch on unresolved trauma. It's kind of like a 2-in-1 question.
Yeah. I think that's such a good question, Astrid. And, you know, when we're talking about like losing weight or getting stronger or changing our body or making really any change, whether, you know, maybe it's getting out of debt or whatever it is, we usually set some kind of goal that's outcome-based. Like I said, it's like, I want to lose 20 pounds or I want to get out of debt. That's an outcome. That's not something that like you do every day. That's something that's down the road, right? We're someplace we're trying to get to. So we set these goals that are outcomes, but in order to get to an outcome, we have to change our behaviors. So you didn't get to where you are. You got to where you are through a set of behaviors or through a set of habits or through a set of practices, whatever you want to call it. So to get somewhere else, you have to change your behaviors. And there's one more layer to that. So you have this big circle is the outcome that you're looking for. And inside that circle is the behavior. So the behaviors are basically the segue to the outcome. But inside the behavior circle is actually something else called identity. In order to change our behaviors, we actually have to change our identity first. This is an idea that James Clear really talks about really, really well. And if I want to lose weight, if I want to, you know, I have to change my identity from someone who's overweight or someone who has trouble losing weight to I'm a fit person, or, you know, it's basically, you know, telling yourself that you are the person that you want to be. You have to visualize it. You have to tell yourself you're that person. Once you change your identity, then you can change your behaviors, because if I'm a fit person, then I'm going to do X, Y, and Z. And X, Y, and Z might be move my body every day, or it might be eat real foods every day. That's because that's the type of person that does those kinds of things that leads to the outcome that you want. Now, I mentioned this earlier, I think towards the beginning, is that changing behaviors is really just developing skills. It's just developing skills. And we all have the ability to develop skills, but it requires patient and persistent practice. So, you know, some people call it habits. Well, these behaviors aren't a habit yet until we practice them and they become automatic. So we have to look at them as practices or behaviors until, you know, some people say it takes 2 months or more to ingrain a habit, but we want those behaviors to ultimately become a habit, to be an autopilot. And so that's why it's so important to focus on the behaviors. And, you know, the umbrella terms for the behaviors that are important for, you know, looking better, feeling better would be things like nutrition and exercise and sleep and stress management. Those are all relationships. Those are all important pieces of the puzzle, But within those categories, there are specific skills that we have to practice. We have, and there's a certain degree of information that we need. And depending on where you are in your journey, you might have this skill that you have to practice to get, whereas someone who may be a little bit further behind or a little bit further ahead might have to break that down a little bit more. And so changing behaviors is the key to the outcomes, because that's what you do on a daily basis. These are things that you can measure every day. I can look at my checklist. Did I do this, this, and this? These are the three things I need to do every day in order to get me one step closer to my outcome. Because I don't get to the outcome just by happenstance. There are certain things magic. I have to do. And so this is another idea here that I think is pretty, that helps visualize this, is something that there's Dan John is a strength coach, and he has these podcasts with Pat Flynn, and Pat Flynn's also a fitness professional. And they talk about this idea of pirate maps. And a pirate map, if you were to think about it, if you saw this picture of a pirate map, it's basically, you know, this, here's the X, and then down here's the treasure. And I've got to take, you know, six paces to the left, go around the coconut tree, and then six paces south, and then whatever. It's very simple. It's just boom, boom, boom to get to the treasure, right? Well, the same idea, if the treasure is the outcome that I want to achieve and I'm right here, then what are the simplest steps that I need to take every single day to get there? So again, it might be exercising for 30 minutes. Did I do that? Check. Did I eat, you know, did I eat slowly and mindfully until I was 80% full? Check. Did I, you know, drink 8 glasses of water? Check. Did I get 7-8 hours of sleep? Check. Did I meditate, or did I practice my nasal breathing? Check. You know, maybe there's 5 or 6 things that I'm practicing, but that's my pirate map. What are the simplest things that I need to do to get to that outcome?
Wow, that's interesting.
And it will vary from person to person based on where you're at in your journey, because not everyone's in the same place. But the idea is to boil it down to things that you can do, because it's the only way to change is with consistent daily action. And going back to something else I said, it's not all or nothing. It's about this continuum and just doing, because something is always going to be better than nothing. So if my pirate map says do 30 minutes of exercise, but I only have time for 10 minutes, is it better for me to do 10 minutes or none? 10. Always going to be better to do 10. Even though 10 wasn't 30, that's okay. Right? So the idea is that only consistent daily action leads to the change, and that we can do anything. We can literally do anything. This growth mindset, we can do anything with patient and persistent practice.
Wow, that's awesome. I love that. And, you know, it's something that I think some people struggle with. And I love that analogy of the map, the pirate map, you know. And as you're talking about it, I'm like, oh my God, you know, like that's something that maybe I could implement myself. Like with me, it's I have this bout of like motivation, lack of motivation, actually. And I know that a lot of people could relate, because like for some people, there is like, I've had this period where like, I have so much motivation that I'm just like at the gym all the time. And I'm like, you know, I'm going, especially like during the summer or whatever. It actually doesn't matter. I love working out, in fact. But there's times where we like, the excuses like during the day, you know, like, oh, I'm too busy for this, or the kids, this or that. Like there is something that when you said that it's very powerful, is like consistency. And also a little bit, it doesn't matter what you like, how much you do, like 10 minutes is better than 30. So I do that. You know, sometimes I'm like, you know what, I couldn't walk during the day. I'm going to go for a walk at night. It's going to benefit me anyway,
right?
You know, even if there's an 8-9 o'clock, I know I'm going to get something out of it. And I also feel better because of my goals. And I'm like, I know this is going to do something. So a little bit is better than nothing, guys. This pirate map analogy is really good. Just remember that. Just replay it if you have to. Something is better than nothing. So yeah. Thank you so much for answering that.
Can I touch on motivation real quick?
Astrid? Oh my God, go for it. Yes.
Motivation is like a cat. It's fickle, it's fleeting. It's not always there. Not even for me, for sure. Not even for me. And there's always days, or always times in a day when I struggle with not having the motivation or not feeling motivated to do. There's some days I don't want to work out, you know, but there's several things that would keep me going. But just in general, when motive here, So what you're talking about, something always better than nothing. Just having that mindset is that, like, you don't have to go all or nothing. That's huge. Just take action. Just do something. Do something. Because sometimes all you got to do is get the ball rolling to build up some momentum. So taking the idea of just think, take action, just do something. That can be enough, because then you just get moving. But there's a couple other things that I want to mention there, that these are pieces of the puzzle that are often missing for people. Accountability and support. Okay. So accountability would be like maybe having a coach, someone who's holding you accountable, saying, hey, did you do your workout today, Astrid? How's that pirate map? Did you check off all your boxes today? And you're not a bad person if you didn't, but sometimes just knowing, man, I know Coach Tim's going to ask me, I don't want to do it today, but I don't want to disappoint him.
Yes. Right.
So accountability is a big piece of the puzzle. And then support. Like, if we always feel we're not meant to do things alone, especially hard things, we're supposed to have a team. We're supposed to have people around us that can support us. So if I see, you know, if I'm, you know, I'm a part of a group, maybe where it's like, ah, oh, man, I know Amy did that workout, I got to do it too. Or, you know, there's support piece of the puzzle. And then just a third thing that I don't always think people always think about is having some skin in the game. What I mean by that is maybe there's money at stake. Maybe there's some kind of bet at stake. Maybe there's a reward there, but sometimes having some skin in the game where it's like an extra layer of accountability where, like, if I don't do this, then this happens. Or if I do this, then this happens. So that's kind of an external source of motivation sometimes, which I'd love for it to always be internal, but sometimes we need a little bit of external as well. So some skin in the game, accountability, and social support. Those are often three elements that are missing that can overcome for that lack of motivation, which I guarantee you everyone struggles with motivation issues.
Oh, absolutely. Awesome. I'm so glad you touched on that, because those are really good points, guys. And I, you know, I'm sure you've heard about this. You know, there is science behind the fact that if you have a community or like a support group, you tend to succeed more. And I actually could speak by experience. Like, I actually love to work out with someone. You know, it's always like good to have, like, although I went by myself for years, right? Because I was like, you know, I have my goal, and I just went anyway, even though it was like after eight for years. And a night. And that's another thing I was going to ask you real quick, just deviating for what are the best, because for me, I just got into this thing because I work from home all day. My me time was a night, and I would go like after 8, and now they're at the gym until 11 o'clock at night, pretty much closing, because I would go into the sauna and I was taking my time. Sometimes I'm chatting with someone and whatever, and doing my workouts and also cardio. So it was like a couple of hours in the gym, and this was all at night. I want to know, based on your experience, right, what do you recommend for some? I know that sometimes we can't get to the gym or to work out until a certain time, but what do you recommend for example for a woman in her 40s like myself? Yeah.
When is the best time to work out? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
I love that question. And my default answer for most questions is going to be that it depends, but people don't like that answer. So the best time to work out is when you have time, when you can make time. That would be the first, because time is the number one excuse or one of the top excuses for most people to not exercise. So let's rule it out. Whenever you have time is the best time to exercise. Okay. So that would be number one. But physiologically speaking, if there was a best time, an ideal time, it looks like it's probably sometime in the early afternoon or early evening. So, you know, between the hours of maybe like, say, 2 and 6 p.m. That's a pretty wide range. So you can narrow it down to between 3 and 5. And what that is based on is hormones and neuromuscular control, nervous system activity, where our strength and, you know, hormones are optimal to do intense exercise. So if I were to say that would be the quote unquote best time to work out. If you have, you know, unlimited time, it would be in that mid-afternoon, early evening range. It's what it looks like. But having said that, the best time is whenever you have time. But I also like this question because I don't think that we have to do all of our exercise at one time. We've already touched on this a little bit, is that, you know, just doing 30 to 60 minutes one time a day isn't combat an otherwise sedentary life. And so one of the big messages that I like to share is this idea of like exercise snacks or movement breaks throughout the day. So there's many times when I know that I'm not going to have 20 or 30 minutes to work out. So I might do 5 or 10 minute little exercise breaks or exercise snacks throughout the day where I take my kettlebell and I do, you know, 20 kettlebell swings every minute on the minute for 5 minutes. Or I do a little complex where it's 5 exercises done, bang, 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 bang. And a lot of times, you know, I'll try to get like a good 20 minute workout in at one point during the day and then have another one of those little 5 or 10 minute exercise snacks later in the day. But there's a lot of people I know that, especially with this current public health crisis where, you know, there's not, they either don't want to go to a gym or they have kids at home or whatever it is where, you know, we're baking in these 5 or 10 minute, exercise snacks throughout the day. And is it the best way to build a ton of muscle, build some strength? Probably not, but it is a great way to stay fit and to keep moving throughout the day. And so again, a long answer to that question, but I think it opens up some opportunities. I think another good time to exercise is, you know, maybe before you're going to have a larger meal to create some space. But I also think it's a good idea to take a walk after your meal if you can, which I know you're a big fan of, Astrid, because it helps the body with metabolizing the sugar if you are consuming carbs. So there are some potentially like ideal times to exercise, but I would never say that if you can't fit it in those times, don't exercise. It'd just be like, just do it when you can. It's always going to win. Something's always better than nothing, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. That's why I love, Coach Tim's approach, because that makes total sense. And I actually learned about, you know what? I actually love the snack thing. I actually found out through, he's the one that came up with that. And I found it in one of his posts on Instagram. And I love that. I actually love that idea. I'm going to start doing some snack exercises.
Here's the other thing, Astrid, is that it's going to help you. You're a businesswoman, you work hard, you do a lot of creative things. And what you'll find is that by that, you're welcome. And thank you for all that you do. And what you'll find is that by doing that those little movement breaks throughout the day, you actually become more creative. So there's this fear that if I step away from my desk, I'm going to miss something or I'm not going to be as productive. But by taking those little breaks, you actually increase blood flow to the brain. You increase your creativity. You become a more lucid and more thoughtful person, and you improve your productivity when you are working. So, you know, I encourage you or anyone who's listening to set a timer for every 30 to 60 minutes throughout the day, whatever you feel comfortable with, and take a, you know, 1 minute, 2 minute break, 5 minute break, whatever you can afford during those times. But it's going to be better to get up and move around, and you're going to feel rejuvenated. You're going to feel more energetic. You're going to feel more creative by doing so. And of course your body will appreciate it as well.
Yes. You know what? I actually love that. And I tried so hard to do that. Like when I remember, because, you know, I have the ability to, even when I worked in corporate, I would be like, you know, every like hour, 2 hours, actually, because of my back mainly, I would just get up and go get a glass of water, go to the bathroom, whatever. But you definitely want to take breaks and you know, Coach Tim is right. Definitely creativity juices will start flowing when you get up and move and things like that. So awesome. Thank you for answering that. We're going to go ahead and move to the next question. And one of your posts on Instagram, which I actually shared, you know, it really caught my attention. It was one of your videos. You had this analogy of, are you mowing your lawn while your house is on fire? I love that post. I love the entire analogy. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's... you know, there's a couple different layers to that, but I think so. I mean, you can just picture this guy out there cutting his grass and his house is on fire. The idea is that we spend a lot of time just obsessing over the minutiae, these little details, without getting the priorities, the important things in order. Like, obviously, we shouldn't be mowing our lawn when the house is on fire. The house is the much bigger priority, but we spend time like just ruminating over, you know, our carrots and bananas too bad because they have too much sugar. You know, is this type of, well, kind of like the question that we just talked about, is the time, what's the best time to exercise? Doesn't matter. Just go do it. You know, is this better than this? But it really, you know, we need to, you know, when it comes to nutrition, we just need to focus on the basics. We need to focus on eating real food. We need to focus on tuning into our body's cues. We need to focus on being consistent. We need to focus on being mindful and being present when we're eating, you know, slowing down, eating till 80% full. We need to just, rather than all the minutia of when's the best, what's the best exercise, when's the best, you know, for this or that, we just need to focus on moving our bodies consistently. And this is speaking to the general population. There's certainly nuances. There's certainly points when you're like, those details matter. But in my experience, many people spend a lot of time procrastinating because of these wondering and worrying types of questions that prohibit them from taking action. Like I said before, the most important thing you do is take action, be consistent, and just put one foot in front of the other and just go. And so that's kind of the idea. Yes. with mowing the lawn with the house on fire, is that we're focused on these little tiny details instead of the big foundational building blocks, the big rocks, so to speak.
Perfect. Yes, that makes total sense. Now, tying it up to that one answer, the next question would be, what are some of the top keys to losing weight and keeping it off, like based on your experience and what you do?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, we sprinkled in some of these things there. So this is a good place to recap. But I think that, you know, it's important to have, we talked about behaviors and outcomes. It is important to have some kind of outcome that you're striving for. I think that there's something that you want to improve, because that's kind of a guiding light to changing the behaviors, to changing the identity. So having some outcome, I think that, you know, having accountability, having some support, having some deadline usually is helpful. You know, that's important, whether it's, you know, 12 weeks or whether it's a year or whatever it is, because we can always, even if it's a year long goal, we can always say, okay, well, that's what we want to accomplish in a year. Well, what are we going to want to accomplish in the next 4 weeks or something like that? So I think it is important to have a goal and a deadline for the goal, have an accountability, have a coach that can help you with the plan. I think those pieces of the puzzle are important, because like I said, there's so much noise. There's so much information out there. So having a coach who can guide you, just like you talked about guiding your son, a coach who can guide you through the process and tell you, or at least give you some options of what might be the next best step to do. As a coach, I don't always like to say, do this or do that, but here's a menu of three or four things that I think would be good for you to focus on next. Which one are you confident that you could do right now? And you know, which behavior, which skill do you want to practice? So a coach becomes really important. So you're not just like program hopping from one thing to the next, as far as exercise goes, or, you know, you're just jumping from a diet to another diet. So the coach becomes really important. There's some more nuances that I think that are important, for the long-term weight loss. And we can look at, you know, it's not completely grim. There's many people that lose a significant amount of weight and keep it off over time. Like, obviously we always hear about people lose weight and they gain more back, but there's many people that lose weight and keep it off. I think consistency is really important. As boring as it sounds, my experience that most people that lose weight and keep it off find kind of a menu of options that food wise that they stick with. Because you run into this problem of like decision fatigue or having all these options, and it just creates problems. And then, you know, so for instance, we have for dinner, we have probably a stable of 10 things that I'll make on a routine basis. And it's just like, which one do we want today? And so I know exactly what to shop for. I know exactly how to cook it without even thinking about it, spending all this energy. So I think this dietary consistency is very important over time. In addition to all those other things that I mentioned too, but, you know, we talked about the calorie counting, things like that. I think changing how we eat is an important piece of the puzzle, meaning that slowing down, being mindful, eating slowly, remove distractions becomes important, because just by slowing down, we can actually learn to tune into those internal cues. So that's an important piece of the puzzle. It's one of the first things that I would start with people is how you eat. We know that when we're distracted, we tend to overeat, not only at that meal, but probably in future meals as well. And not to mention make less healthy choices. And focusing, again, I don't like to say foods are good or bad, but we do want to talk about if our goal is to lose weight, then we want to choose foods that are consistent with that goal. So eating more whole, minimally processed foods. And again, I've said this several times already, but just being consistent is a big player too. So those would be a few keys, I think, in moving our bodies every day in a variety of ways and throughout the day is also an important piece of the puzzle. Sleep is another piece of the puzzle that you and I have talked yes. about a lot. Stress management is another piece of the puzzle. So there's several keys there, but I think those are the big ones.
Nice. Thank you. Yes. Makes total sense. Very good points. Sleeping is crucial. I struggle with that. As some of you know, I always talk about it and, but I'm actually working, towards that. And something very important, guys, is that you, just become aware of what you, the things that you are potentially not strong, the areas that you're not being consistent with, and focus on that. At least that's what I'm doing. And I was actually that with the help of Coach Tim, you know, try to become more aware of the areas that you're kind of weak. For putting it another way, and that'll sometimes helps to make those changes. So thank you so much for answering that phenomenal answer. Tying it up with a little bit with what you were saying, the exercise. What are the best types of exercise for someone who's always had trouble losing weight? For example, this time is like, okay, I need to make changes. I am fully invested. I want to make changes to do what I have to do to lose the weight. What you just mentioned, what Coach Tim just mentioned, the last 5 minutes, or actually the entire podcast, it's crucial in getting healthier or reaching your goals, right? It's not just one thing. But for example, for exercise, what are some of the exercises? Because there's so much, you know, we were talking about it, cardio for an hour. I think a lot of you know at this point that it's not really, what is that? I'm just trying to look for the right word. It is beneficial, but it's not really for certain goals, right?
Probably not the most efficient way to get there.
There you go. Thank you. Efficient. So what would you say would be like based on the new research, what you do works, because I've obviously been following you and you know your stuff. What do you think works for someone who really wants to get down and dirty with the little sleep?
Yeah. I love that question. Thanks, Astrid. Because I talked about before that even before exercise, I think just building more activity into your daily life, low level physical activity into your daily life is probably the first place that I would go. I'll answer that question very specifically, but there's this component of metabolism called, so when we talk about metabolism, we'll refer to as how many calories we burn over the course of a day. And there's just this basal metabolic rate. We burn some calories when we eat. It's called thermic effective feeding. We burn calories when we exercise. It's called exercise specific thermogenesis. And then there's another category called non-exercise activity thermogenesis. And so there's this whole other category of metabolic rate that essentially encompasses all the activity we do, the spontaneous activity that we do throughout the day that's not really exercise. So NEAT, N-E-A-T, non-exercise activity thermogenesis is the acronym for this. And that's a piece of the puzzle that I really like to emphasize because we have so much control over it. And this is like that idea of getting up every 30 to 60 minutes and moving your body around, just taking 10, 15 minute walks, which I wouldn't consider exercise. I would just consider activity, this low level physical activity throughout the day. I don't think there's any magic per se to 10,000 steps a day, but I do think it's like a good goal to shoot for is somewhere in that 7,000 to 15,000 steps a day. And it doesn't have to be walking steps. It can just be activity, but I think that's a good place for people to start. You just, again, it's going to help you mind, body, spirit to be that active. So that's a pillar for me is just to be more active throughout the day in that range. As far as if someone is ready for exercise, then I would do a combination of resistance training, strength training, like weight training, whatever you want to call it, and some type of conditioning. Okay. And so I'll get a little more specific with that. But with the resistance training, I'd say somewhere between 2, 3, and 4 days a week of for many people, it's going to be full body workouts. For some people, it might be upper body one day and lower body the other day. But for a lot of people, it's going to be full body workouts. we're working the major movement patterns. We're squatting, we're deadlifting, or doing what's called hip hinging, or pressing, or pushing, or pulling, we're rowing, things like that. And we're doing, you know, a number of sets of these exercises for, you know, whatever reps, depending on what our goal is. But that would be, you know, let's say 3 days a week for that. And the goal there is to build or maintain muscle and or strength during this process, because that becomes really important. So what we're talking about here is quality weight loss. When I say quality weight loss, it's not just about watching the number go down a scale. It's about fat loss combined with building muscle and or maintaining muscle, because muscle is metabolically active. It influences our quality of life, our functional capacity. And like you and I have talked about, that muscle is the major storage organ for carbohydrate, for sugar. It's the tank. This is the major tank in the body. So our muscles, depending on how big we are, can hold about 450 grams of carbohydrate. Okay. And then when we empty that tank, then the carbs that we do eat have a place to go besides fat, right? So our liver can store a little bit too, but our muscles are the main storage engine, main storage tank for carbohydrate. So when we do resistance training, we empty the tank, so our carbs have a place to go. The other cool thing is that when we do eat carbs after resistance training, is that these little receptors rise to the surface of the muscle cell. They're called GLUT4 transporters. And what these little GLUT4 transporters do is they soak up glucose out of the bloodstream through non-insulin or insulin-independent mechanisms to lower blood sugar. So resistance training is just a great tool for metabolic health, for looking great, for being strong. And people don't know this, but strength, muscle strength, is one of the biggest predictors of longevity and health spans. So that's an important piece of the puzzle. Okay, so we got the low level physical activity component, we've got the strength training component, and then 2, 3, maybe 4 days a week, depending on what you're capable of, we would do some type of conditioning. This one is a little bit more variant depending on the type of person, but a lot of times it's just, you know, maybe a little bit more of a brisk walk, getting your heart rate up a little bit more. So Phil Maffetone would be a guy that I would look into to kind of look into some of his methods, but he would say, take, I think it's 180 minus your age. And that's kind of 180, 160 to 180 minus your age. And that's kind of your target heart rate for those types of activities, if your goal is fat loss and metabolic health. So that would be one way to go about it. But also high end, Go ahead, Astrid.
Yeah, I'm sort of cut you off real quick. I wanted to double check it. And I recently learned, and is this accurate? There's a fat burning heart rate.
Fat burning zone, yeah.
Fat burning zone. And I was like, oh my God, how come nobody ever told me this? I could do this 120, between 120 and 140. That's not even so hard when I'm on the treadmill. Right. I'm like, I could do this every day if that's the fat burning thing. That's all I could do.
Yeah.
Tell me about that. Is that accurate?
That's a great question. I do have some problems with that. Now, having some, I said that just with the Maffetone method, that he kind of talks about that too. I think his method is a little bit more precise and it's proven in his practice. But my problem with the fat burning zone is, to some degree, is that sometimes it's too low of an intensity for some people. Okay. So that's, and so it's based on this. Yeah. It's based on this idea that you take 220 minus your age and then you multiply it by, usually like 60% or something like that, that people would say is the fat burning zone. And it's true that at lower to moderate intensities, your body's going to burn generally a higher percentage of calories from fat. Okay. And so you're burning, we're always burning a mixture of fat and carbohydrate. How much the ratio of that varies depending on our diet, our metabolism, our metabolic health, and the intensity of activity. So just in terms of intensity of activity, as intensity of activity increases, the body relies more heavily on sugar, on carbohydrate. As intensity decreases, your body can rely more heavily on aerobic metabolism of fat. And so just standing here or just sitting there, we're burning a higher percentage of fat. So we're in the fat burning zone right now.
I'm sure you're burning more than I am.
Well, that, you know,
next time we'll just have the treadmill.
Right. I like the idea of the treadmill desk. So there's truth to the fat burning zone. My problem is if we're exercising at too low of intensity for say 20 minutes and I'm only burning like 50 calories, but I could exercise a little bit harder during that time and burn more calories, that's going to have a bigger bang for the buck. So the choice of fuel for a lot of people during exercise is not as important as how much fuel they're burning. And so that's where I have a little bit of an issue with that. But at the other end of the spectrum, I think that, you know, like there's many benefits to high intensity interval training. It's a time efficient strategy. There's, you know, it's going to activate all these anti-aging pathways. Potentially there's great benefits to high intensity interval training, but I think that we can overdo it sometimes. And I think that some people, especially like if we're talking, you know, we talked about people who have cognitive dietary restraint and they're, you know, stressed out to begin with, those really high intensity activities, especially when we're already doing some high intensity resistance training, it can just be a little too much.
Oh,
and
wow.
So I don't always prescribe the high intensity interval training unless someone is very pressed for time. But a lot of times, you know, I think that the more aerobic based conditioning is useful if we can find the appropriate intensity level. So the Maffetone method usually gets people to exercise a little bit harder than that traditional 220 minus your age, take a percentage of that. So the Maffetone method is usually a little bit higher. So I like it from that standpoint. But you know, sometimes interval training is helpful and sometimes it's a very good tool, very efficient, but I think we just have to be mindful of the situation, the person, and things like that.
Awesome. Thank you for answering that. I'm going to throw deviate a little bit from that, since where I think this is very important and it's something that I learned recently, thanks to you. And I'm sure maybe some people out there could relate. So, you know, I'm always testing my sugars because of my family history, whatever. I recently, you know, I have this thing with my insulin resistance and stuff like that. And so I wanted to you to share this with us because I asked you and you told me something pretty interesting. When I brought this up to you, I did a high intensity interval training session for 20 minutes. I had tested my sugars and they were on the higher end. But then when I did the HIIT, I tested it. I was like, oh, you know, because I've watched videos where it says when you do HIIT, you're going to lower your sugars. And so I tested whenever, I don't know, 15 minutes later after that session, my sugars went 40 points higher. And I was like,
right.
What is this? Like, I just exercised, I'm out of breath, I'm drenched, and I'm like, what just happened? And you explained it to me very eloquently. Why don't you share that with our audience and what can potentially happen? What happened and what can they do about it?
Yeah. So, I mean, exercise just throws all the rules out the window. It's just a game. I mean, like you start measuring blood pressure during exercise, that changes things. You start measuring blood sugar and fatty acids during exercise, that change. It's just a completely different physiological environment than, you know, the postprandial after we eat state or the fasted state. Exercise is a completely different animal. So especially with the high intensity interval training, something like that, like it's basically like this idea of, like we talked about with the stress before, that the sympathetic nervous system kicks in. This is your fight or flight response. Again, this is just part of the process. It's not bad. Again, there's this duality. We want it to kick in during exercise because it's kicking in order to liberate fuel. Your body's like, crap, you're asking me to do a lot of work right now. I gotta get this energy out there in order for your muscles to do what they need to do. And so it would be completely normal to experience, you know, an increase in blood glucose and fatty acids during and even to a point after exercise. In fact, if you would measure fatty acids too, which you can't just do at home, but we would expect free fatty acids to be highly elevated after intense exercise. That's why I think one of the most effective things you can do for fat loss is take a walk after you do some kind of high intensity interval training or resistance training, because theory, and usually in practice, you have elevated free fatty acids. And like we talked about, the best way to use those free fatty acids in that quote unquote fat burning zone is a lower to moderate intensity activity like walking. But anyway, going back to your question, is that you basically created a stimulus for your body to liberate more glucose from whether it's the muscles or the liver or wherever, because you store carbohydrate in the liver as glycogen in order to fuel things like exercise. And so this high intensity interval training was a stimulus for your body to use it. Now, I think that, you know, metabolically speaking, let's try to put this the appropriate way, that your body doesn't operate exactly the same way as, you know, completely healthy person who has normal blood sugar regulation. And so it seems like there might be some, you know, issues with sugar getting into the cells. Like you talk, when you're insulin resistant, what that's saying is that the sugar is having a hard time getting into the cells it needs to. And so you might have experienced a greater increase because the sugar's knocking on the door, but the cells aren't answering because they become resistant to that signal, which is insulin. And that might be part of the reason why, you know, you're a little bit higher baseline, but it would be for anybody, it would be normal to experience some elevated blood sugar during and after exercise shortly afterwards, but you would expect that to return to baseline within an hour or so.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. So was that probably like an isolated, like if you're already dealing with a little bit of insulin resistance and things like that, that's a common occurrence just for someone like that, or in general? I didn't get that. In general, you said that other people could experience that.
In general, gotcha. Right. In general, you would see an increase above baseline.
Gotcha. Yes. Gotcha. Awesome. Yeah. Thank you for answering that, guys. Super important. You see how you always have to pay attention. I've tested, with the glucometer. I also had I'm looking to get a continuous glucose monitor. I see a lot of athletes are doing it, and some of the coaches and people like that are encouraging to do that. I don't know how you feel about a continuous glucose for someone who already has, like, how do you feel about that?
I think it's a particularly useful tool for someone in your situation, really for anybody, because what you're going to see with the continuous glucose monitor is what's something called glycemic variability. So it's not just about, you know, these snapshots in time when it comes to blood glucose management. It's really about the peaks and valleys. So the variability from, you know, the ups and downs over the course of the day, what scientists would call the area under the curve. So how much do things vary from baseline over the course of the day? And ideally we want things to be pretty tightly regulated. You know, healthy might be considered between 80 and 120, but, you know, fasting or between 80 and 100 fasting, and then maybe up to 150 or so after eating. But anyway, the continuous blood glucose monitor would give us this global picture of what's happening to blood sugar. And that glycemic variability is going to be more relevant to all the health outcomes that we're interested in. So the blood glucose monitor is a useful tool, but the continuous blood glucose monitor tells us a little bit more, and would probably tell us more in that exercise situation. How well are we metabolizing sugar during and after exercise, as opposed to just that one snapshot? There was something else I was going to add there, but it escapes me right now. So I do think it would be useful for someone in your situation, Astrid, to try the continuous blood glucose monitor.
Perfect. Awesome. Thank you for answering that. We're going to start. I don't know how you are on time. Do you have time for one more question? Thank you so much. All right. So we're going to start wrapping it up, guys. But I think this is a real, Coach Tim wrote this up. We were going to talk about hormones, but we didn't want to, he didn't want to generalize it, which is really good. Hormones is such a broad, topic, but he wanted to touch up on leptin, what we were talking about. Go ahead. Take it away.
Yeah. And thanks for pointing that out, Astrid, that I just don't like to view things in isolation in the body, because nothing works alone. And there's not one single hormone. There's not one single thing that's the key to everything. Again, it's our simplistic primal brain that likes to see things in black and white and to boil things down as simple as possible. But that's just not how the body works. It's an incredibly complex, beautiful piece of equipment or whatever. Yeah, it's amazing. So, it's just amazing. Hopefully we can understand more and more about it every day. But what I wanted to talk about this one for is because I know that so many people feel like they're broken, or that, you know, that they're they just don't work the right way because they struggle with weight loss, or they can't keep the weight off, or, you know, just to feel like their body's messed up. And I just want to point out that that your body is basically set up to work against you when it comes to weight loss. And that's not meant to sound grim, because there's ways to deal with it, but it's just meant to provide this foundation of understanding. And what the body does, it has these series of energy preservation and energy sensing mechanisms in place. And so the idea with weight loss is that we, going back to one of the first things we talked about, we eat less, we move more, right? We create this energy deficit, because that's what you need to do. You need to burn more calories than you consume in order to see that number on the scale go down. And there, that's true. Okay, let's just say that's the truth. But as you do that, the body can sense that there's this mismatch between how many calories you're burning and how many calories you're consuming. And it does this through a number of ways, but one of the most important ones is this hormone leptin, which is a satiety hormone, but it's also this energy sensing hormone. And so leptin is secreted primarily by fat cells, and it's monitoring both short-term and long-term energy. And what I mean by that is, like, as you have this calorie deficit, you're consuming fewer calories than you burn, leptin levels start to decline. And that's telling your body that there's this energy mismatch. And because leptin is secreted by fat cells largely, as you lose fat, your body has less leptin to produce as well. So you have this kind of double whammy of a decrease in leptin. What does that mean? Well, all it's signaling is, it's basically a signal to the body that it needs to kick in its energy preservation, its metabolic adaptations. This is called adaptive thermogenesis. So the body's going to kick in a variety of metabolic adaptations in order to get the energy in, the energy out, and energy in to match up more closely. So you'll start to feel hungry, mm-hmm. and you'll start to feel hungry in particular for highly palatable, energy dense foods. So this is where, like, you get that voracious appetite. No matter how much you eat, you just can't stop, because your body's just fighting against your will to lose weight, right? From that standpoint. And from an energy output standpoint, your body becomes more efficient. And you and I talked about this before, Astrid. If we want to lose fat, we actually want to be less efficient. We want to be inefficient with our metabolism so we can burn more calories.
That was pretty interesting.
I know it sounds crazy. This is where inefficiency becomes important. But when we have this drop in leptin, things become more efficient. So, you know, that 2 mile run that I took before burned 200 calories. Well, now it's only burning 150 calories. And this also feeds into that calories in versus calories out counting thing that we talked about before. We can't really account for those types of things. So the another thing is the parasympathetic nervous system starts to kick in more. So we lose less of that sympathetic tone, which can drive metabolism, things like that. We also start to see an impact on thyroid hormone and on reproductive hormones. So all these things that would require energy, all the reproductive systems that require energy, they're going to start to slow down. That's why maybe it's harder to get pregnant or something like that when you're, you know, in the face of an energy deficit. So again, all of these things are just kind of building up and mounting in order to get to what's called homeostasis, this sense of balance, right? Now, what happens is that, you know, we can ease into it over time. There's different things you can do with your diet. Like, there's some recent research shows that instead of having this, like, chronic calorie deficit, where the kind of traditional thought is that in order to lose weight, you have to eat like 500 calories less every single day and get that, you know, build up that energy deficit. But there's something now called intermittent energy restriction, where maybe you eat less 3, 4, 5 days a week, and then maybe have maintenance calories twice a week. So more of a cycling of calories. Maybe that's on a weekly basis. Maybe it's on, you know, a bi-weekly basis, but that seems to mitigate some of this adaptive thermogenesis. Mm. But just being aware of it, this is where the non-exercise activity thermogenesis also comes into play, because one of the things that the body's going to do is it's going to subconsciously reduce that our subconscious activity, because it wants to match energy intake with energy output. And that's something else we can do. If we bake in these exercise snacks throughout the day, we can kind of combat that adaptive thermogenesis that way too. But I point out leptin because it seems to be a major signaling pathway behind all these energy preservation mechanisms. Not that leptin is good or bad. It's just doing its job, and that's what its responsibilities are.
Wow, that's phenomenal. Listen, just so you guys know, like real quick, in the past, I actually went overseas to see my mother. Had had a stroke, and I decided to go to a functional medicine or like a wellness center. This was that down in South America, so a lot cheaper than here. And I decided to go. And for years, I had been dealing with the weight, despite of, you know, working out like almost like, well, that's not a good thing either, but almost 5 times a week, very active diet, whatever. And it was only there where I found out my doctors here, I hate to say this, but my doctor was negligent, because my doctor never said, oh, gee, let's look at your hormones. None of my doctors, OBGYN, which I think OBGYNs should really do a hormonal panel by default, my regular doctor, whatever. And when I went there, I took this test where it's like a biomagnetic or whatever, scan your organs. And I found out that I was severely leptin resistant. I had no idea. Mm. And he said, the reason why I can tell that is not in terms of lifestyle, like diet, is because your triglycerides, everything was good. Triglycerides, everything, including my insulin was good. My fasting glucose, whatever, was still good, but it was leptin resistant. And so, you know, at that point, I was like, oh, now I understand a lot of the issues that I'm having. I didn't know this. So you guys have to be proactive and ask your doctors for these tests. Ask your, for women, OBGYN, can you please run a hormonal panel, or your, what is that? The other one, the primary. And if they don't do it, just fire your doctor and go to another one. That's what I did. You know what I mean? Because they basically work for you, but they have to work with you. So that's very important. Thank you so much for addressing that. And so guys, I think we're going to wrap it up at this point. Coach Tim, is there anything you wanted to end the podcast with our audience?
No. Well, I mean, I think that, I think we covered a lot of ground there, and I just want to say it was a privilege, if you're still listening, that you joined us for this, and just want to encourage you to keep moving forward and just, you know, whatever, how big or small action you take today, just be proud of yourself for taking action. And just remember that something's always better than nothing, and that you can do anything you want when you put your mind to it. Just going to require patient and persistent practice. And if you're listening to this, I know that I want you to know that we're proud of you for taking your health so seriously, and we're here for you. And we talked about how important support is. And we're here to be here however you need us. So it's just been an honor to join you so far. And we look forward to taking the next step with you together.
Awesome. We are. I am so looking forward to it as well. Guys, if you want to connect, and you should, actually you must connect with Coach Tim. Don't forget to visit, interact, and tell him that you learned about him via the podcast, Healing Naturally Wellness Podcast. You can follow Tim on Instagram at Coach Tim Fitness, and you can also check out some of his workouts on YouTube. I am going to provide the link on his dedicated page on my website. You can catch Tim on his weekly live Q&As for BioTrust Nutrition on Instagram at BioTrust Nutrition on Instagram. And that's actually how we met. And it was, I loved it. It was full of information. You are able to ask questions. That's exactly how we got acquainted and started talking about all this nutrition and what I'm doing. So definitely go to those. They're full of information, really good. You could also follow him on Facebook at Facebook, that BioTrust. And you can.
Yeah, that would just be
BioTrust. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, just that. Just search BioTrust on Facebook.
There you go, even easier. And you could also join Coach Tim for his live workout several times a month on Amazon Live. And to connect with him, email him at tim@skwiat@gmail.com. Don't you worry about anything. I'm going to have all the links to his email, to his social media platforms. Definitely go and do the, if you're able to do the workouts on Amazon Live. I was able to do one, like part of one, but then I had to run, but definitely go check them out. Coach Tim, it was an absolute pleasure and honor to have you. I cannot wait to have you again. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Astrid. My pleasure. Thank you so much for all that you're doing.
Thank
you're amazing.
You too.
Hey, guys. So today might be your lucky day. I will be picking a few lucky reviewers. Each will win a copy of my ebook, Top 10 Foods for a Super Healthy Lymphatic System. And you will be chosen randomly, of course, and will be contacted once I pick the winners. So go ahead and give me your best review, honest, obviously, and good luck.